My name's Todd, and I am an alcoholic and a drug addict. My sobriety date is May 10th, 2015. Thanks for the intro, Trey. It's very sweet. Man, I'm really nervous about this one. I've never talked this long. See, I guess I'll start at the beginning. Born in Cincinnati, Ohio. Lived there a few months. Moved around a little bit in my younger years because of my dad's job. Lived in Grand Rapids, Michigan for a few years. That's where my whole family's from. My mom and dad both born and raised there. Then we ended up in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And then at 8 years old, we ended up in Plano, Texas. And that's where I did most of my growing up. 8 to 21 was Plano. That's where I started drinking and doing all that kind of stuff. My home life, I had two sisters growing up, older sister, younger sister, stay-at-home mom, you know, Midwestern. My dad was a, you know, football player fraternity dude, and then he was, you know, Vietnam vet Marine. And my mom was just your normal, you know, she went to school to be a dental hygienist and then met my dad and started having kids and stayed home and took care of us. My dad, my grandfather, my dad's father, was a son of, you know, Norwegian immigrants. They lived like on the Canadian border in Minnesota on a farm, you know, and I remember my grandfather and my father, you know, being just very reserved, you know. It wasn't, my dad, you know, they were never mean. They were never really angry. They just didn't show any emotion. They were strict, but, there was never any abuse. But I think, you know, having those male role models in my life, I believed that that's how a man was supposed to be, and I think I kind of took that to an extreme. You know, as I got older, I emotion was, you know, never anything that I was comfortable showing, unless it was anger. You know, I could be pissed off, but you know, being vulnerable, showing any kind of weakness was not something I was comfortable with. But I'll get into that later. So I grew up. I did well in school. I was honors student, gifted and talented program growing up, and I was never really comfortable with that. You know, I didn't want to hang around the fucking nerds. I wanted to hang around the popular kids, and there were, you know, and I can recall, you know, this is all looking back, since I never really thought about this shit much till I got sober, but, I wanted to hang out with, like, the popular kids, but I remember hanging out with them and never quite feeling like I fit it. You know, I'd hang out with them, and then I didn't want to hang out with them. I didn't quite feel right there either. So, you know, 13, 14 years old, I discovered skateboarding, and that seemed to jive more with, you know, what I was into, and that became my life. You know, Thrasher magazine. In fact, seeing Chris Gates's band long before I knew who Chris Gates was in Thrasher magazine back when I was, you know, a kid. And you know, getting into punk rock music, and you know, I soon started hanging out with kids that were into the same shit as I was. And you know, my parents, you know, they didn't really get the whole skateboard and punk rock thing. They weren't, like, super anti, but they didn't get it, you know. It was so not what, you know, and especially my dad, you know, it was so far off from what, you know, and I can imagine growing up in the Midwest, you know, that's just, it was foreign to him, you know, riding on a fucking skateboard. You know, if it wasn't team sports, it just didn't make much sense. You know, he coached my sister's soccer team, my little sister, and that was, like, his whole life. And so started hanging out with my punk rock friends. 15 years old. I remember I was just turned 15. I got drunk for the first time. And, you know, like you'll hear people say so often, it was that first night, you know, Mad Dog, smoking Marlboro Reds in my friend's backyard, mixing it with Sprite because it tasted like shit. And that first drunk, you know, I remember that was, you know, it was on. Like, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And, you know, that my friends and I, like, that's what we looked forward to. You know, we had one of our friends worked at a car wash where there's no shortage of dirtbags that'll buy 15-year-olds booze, you know. So we were set up every weekend, and that, you know, that's what we looked forward to, and that's what we did. and, you know, time went on. Started getting in a little trouble here and there, run-ins with the cops. I'd get into it with my parents. You know, the more I'd wanted less and less to do with my family. You know, I wanted to hang out with my friends all the time. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to be able to drink. I wanted to be able to do what the fuck I wanted to do. There were a couple times, you know, I'd get kicked out of my house, or I'd, you know, run away, technically. But the first time I got arrested was for being a runaway. I continued to go to school as a runaway, which people never really understand. I'm not sure. I guess I didn't know what else to do, but cops came and arrested me at school for being a runaway, and that was my first run-in. But summer after my junior year, yes, it was the last day of school, and I was grounded for something, and Danzig was coming to town, and there was no fucking way. It was the first album they were on tour, and there was no way I was missing that show, right? And I was like, fuck it, I'm going to the show. I stayed out all weekend. Wasn't supposed to leave the house. Got home on that Monday, and I remember it was, I guess I had forgotten it was a holiday. My dad was home from work, and I didn't have my key, and my dad answered the door. I remember, and he's like, you know, pack your shit and get out of here. You got 10 minutes. And I was out that whole summer, and me and a couple of my friends who, you know, single mom kind of kids, that we were, you know, didn't have many rules, and we were just kind of out, hanging out all summer, drinking. Started getting into some run-ins with the cops. I actually got a felony arrest that summer. And finally, you know, I'd stayed in touch with my mom, and she was always kind of my biggest fan, my enabler, you know. She'd meet me and take me out to lunch every once in a while, and, you know, maybe throw me a couple bucks. But they were starting to get worried. My senior year started, and I didn't go back to school, so my mom, like, set me up and had me basically kidnapped to one of those wildlife, you know, survive in the desert programs in Utah. These dudes, like, pretended, I say pretended, they sort of gave me the impression they were cops. They handcuffed me, put me in this van, and threw me on an airplane and flew me to Utah. needless to say, that was on my fourth step. so, you know, you made it through the survival in the desert Utah deal. It was pretty awful. Went back, finished my senior year, and somehow managed to score high enough on my SATs to get into college. Went to school down in San Marcos, and I didn't really give a fuck about going to college, but I had a girlfriend at the time that was going to school there, so plus, you know, I didn't know what else to do. Like, that's what you're supposed to do, right? Go to college after high school. But college was the first time that I could drink every day, and so I did. And so, you know, there was a lot of Pabst Blue Ribbon and swimming in the river and not a whole lot of going to class. So I think I lasted about 3 semesters before they finally had enough of me and told me I was no longer welcome at Southwest Texas State University. So in the meantime, my parents had gotten a divorce. Turns out my dad had an affair, and, you know, he was with this new chick. My mom's devastated. And I went back home after college, and at this point my dad's got a little apartment, and he's playing, you know, the guilty cool dad, letting me drink, you know, at his place. And they're both, he's seeing his new mistress, and my mom's dating. So it was kind of a free-for-all. I'm living at my mom's house, and, you know, drinking. And, you know, that was just the norm. That's what I did. I drank, and I drove, and I didn't give a fuck. And, you know, the consequences were pretty mild at this point. I'd get pulled over for having shitty stickers on my car, and I'd never pay my tickets, and I'd go to jail for stuff like that, but never, you know, never anything serious. 21, I decided to move to Atlantic City, New Jersey. And that was my first experience with 24-hour bars. Which was good for somebody that liked to drink like I did. And then I soon found, you know, hand in hand with 24-hour bars was cocaine, you know. Help you go all night. I worked nights, you know. I went in at 10 p.m. and I'd get off work at, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 in the morning, and then we'd go to the bars. And on the weekends, you know, I'd start drinking at 10 p.m. and you know, drink and do blow till 6, 7 in the morning. And I liked cocaine a lot. And I soon found that better than snorting cocaine was smoking it. And that sort of ramped up the consequences. You know, that along with eventually after smoking for a while, I found that snorting a little heroin at the end of the night was a great way to fucking take the edge off. So, you know, I was starting to see financial consequences and, you know, problems with my relationships. And you know, this whole time, my family's living, you know, in Texas at this point. I guess my whole family was still in Texas. and, you know, so they don't know what the fuck's going on. I remember my mom co-signed a credit card for me. I was trying to get a car or something, and rather than just give me money, they co-signed a credit card with like a $10,000 limit. And when I, you know, I'm in the middle of smoking a lot of crack and with a $10,000 limit on a credit card, that was when, you know, I had to come clean to my parents because I blasted through that money pretty quick. And I, you know, I went to my family. I didn't know what else to do. You know, I had no interest in getting sober, but that's when I went to treatment for the first time. You know, the girlfriend was on my ass. I had to tell my mom, you know, what I had done with the money. And so at this point, my mom was remarried and living in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. So they found a treatment center in Arkansas, not too far from where they lived. And this is in 2000. And this was my first introduction to the 12 steps. And I knew right away that I wanted nothing to do with the 12 steps. I knew right away, you know, I'm in Arkansas, right? I'm in this treatment center. I'm living in New Jersey, and all, you know, there's a couple drinkers there, but I'd say 95% of the people were in there for meth. And no offense to any methamphetamine users, but I couldn't relate. You know, these were a bunch of backwoods Arkansas, you know, teeth falling out meth heads, and, you know, I just like to smoke cocaine and snort heroin, you know. So I was like, these fucking people. I remember I was stood in line one day for the meds. I'll never forget this story. I like telling it still. These two young girls were in front of me, and they were talking about their teeth falling out, right? And I remember the one, you know, the one's kind of nodding her head, looking at the other one. She goes, "Oh, I just dig mine out with an ice pick." And I was like, I remember like, oh, god damn, you motherfuckers need rehab. And so, you know, I swore right there I was never, ever going to do this 12-step shit. I didn't believe, first of all, that it would work for me. I didn't want to get sober anyway, but I decided at that point that, you know, 12-step programs probably worked for weak-minded people. You know, I equated it to the kind of, you know, I used to tell people this all the time when I would talk shit about AA. I would say, you know, AA works for the same kind of people that you see get hypnotized in a bar, you know, and made to, like, cluck like a chicken or some shit like that. You know, that's what I believed, or whether I believed it or not, I like to tell everybody that. And so the day I got out of treatment in Arkansas, I had an older sister, and she had been diagnosed with MS a few years prior to that. She was married. She had a kid. And I got out of treatment and went home, went back to my mom's house, my mom and my stepdad's, and my sister's husband calls from Georgia, and he's like, you know, Tammy, my sister, she's like, I had to take her to the hospital. She's gotten to where she can't swallow. You know, I mean, she couldn't eat food. She'd been to where she couldn't talk for a while. She was in a wheelchair, and it was just progressively getting worse. And so that next day, we drove to Georgia, and spent a month there while she was in hospice and basically just watching her die. And, you know, I stayed sober for maybe a week out of treatment. You know, I did a pretty good job of convincing my family that, you know, drugs were my problem, but I can have some drinks, you know. So we were there for that month. You know, we're going out to eat every meal, and, you know, I'm having cocktails with my dinners and whatnot, and, you know, keeping it pretty well under control for the family. But I, you know, definitely no attempt at staying sober. She passed away about a month later, and I ended up going back to New Jersey, and at that point, you know, the girlfriend I had broke up with me while I was in treatment, and I was going back to the East Coast, and I didn't really have anything. I'd lost my job, and I ended up moving into a sober living house. What I actually much later found out was an Oxford house in Philadelphia. And remember, I interviewed, and I moved in that day, and I packed my shit, you know, unpacked my stuff into my bedroom, and I walked down to South Street. It was not far from South Street, kind of like the Philly's 6th Street or something, if you had to compare it to something. But I run into this girl standing out in front, a girl that I knew from New Jersey, and she was actually the first person I'd ever done heroin with, and I saw her standing outside the store. And, you know, I was like, what are you doing? She's like, oh, I'm about to get off work, and I'm going to go score some dope. You want to come with me? I was like, fuck yeah, I do. And that was the first day I stuck a needle in my arm. Did not last long in that sober house. You know, I guess within maybe 6 months, a friend and I played in a band up in New Jersey, and a friend of mine and I decided I wanted to move to Austin. My younger sister was living here. And I kind of, you know, it was time for a change of scenery. And so my friend and I moved to Austin in April of 2001. And got here, and I managed to stay away. I never sought out heroin, at least for some years, and I'll get to that. But it was I was mainly able to keep it to, you know, drinking and doing cocaine. And... you know, it was an everyday thing for sure, but, you know, I was able to keep jobs. You know, my first job here I kept for almost 5 years, and then, I was, you know, got a job at Central Market. Then I switched over to the big Whole Foods downtown when it opened. And, you know, drinking, doing cocaine all the time, like everybody in Austin does. And, eventually, you know, I drank and I drove every night. I'd drive to the bar, I'd get shit-faced, do a bunch of blow, and drive home. And I finally got a DWI. And I remember, you know, I just kind of took it in stride, and I was like, you know, I've driven drunk maybe thousands of times at this point. I was like, I get this out of the way. I was like, odds are I'm probably not going to get another one, you know. Sobriety never crossed my mind. Not driving drunk never crossed my mind. Because the consequences were, you know, there weren't any to speak of. you know, got bonded out. I got a lawyer, and it just kept getting reset and reset and reset. Which was fine until I got a second DWI while still on bond for my first. And the judge was not too jazzed about that, and they gave me a SCRAM device, right? So I could not drink. At this point, I was working in a bar along with working at Whole Foods, and, you know, I remember thinking, again, sobriety never crossed my mind, but I remember thinking, like, I got to do something, you know? And just so happened I had started dating this girl, and... maybe 3 days after my DUI, she sits me down. She's like, listen, I need to talk to you. And she tells me, she goes, I'm addicted to OxyContin. And I was like, cool. I was like, hook it up. You know, I love opiates. And so started snorting OxyContins since I couldn't drink. you know, that probably lasted, I'm going to say maybe a month. She lived in Denton, so I'd only see her for a few days at a time. And I think after one time of hanging out with her for maybe 4 or 5 days, she goes back to Denton, and I remember I'm kind of like, I don't feel so hot, you know, after snorting oxys for 4 or 5 days. And I, you know, I remember thinking, like, I could probably go find some heroin in this town. And so I did. And that was probably in 2007, I guess. And that was kind of the beginning of the end. You know, started shooting heroin every day. And the consequences started piling up, started losing jobs, started getting arrested. You know, there was treatment again, there were detoxes. And I started doing, you know, I could, you know, in hindsight, I could just see myself, you know, turning into a shitty person. And, you know, again, my family at this point, you know, my sister had moved away from Austin. She's living in Las Vegas by this point, and... you know, my dad's in Dallas. I hadn't talked to my dad. You know, we had a falling out back in 2000, and that's a whole other story I'll get to in a little bit. But and my mom and stepdad are in Arkansas. So, you know, I'm telling these people, you know, anything they know about me is what I tell them. So, you know, that me going to treatment for, again, in 2013 was a big shock to them. But, you know, I'm like, hey, you know, I'm doing good and getting my shit together. And they're like, you know, we're proud of you and here's some money for cigarettes. And, you know, that's how it usually went. Getting a little lost here. Went to treatment in San Antonio in 2013. Didn't stay sober. Didn't even stay sober through treatment. I was getting high in treatment. I got out. I tried to keep it together. I think I kept a job for a little bit. Couldn't manage to keep a job. And I was talking to my sister, and you know, and it was always, you know, I always said, you know, oh, you know, Austin's fucked up. And it was always like, if I could go somewhere else that didn't suck, maybe my life would be better. You know, the typical shit. So I went to Las Vegas, where my sister lives. Went to Las Vegas to get my shit together, which turns out was a terrible idea. In Las Vegas' defense, I think no matter where I had gone, it would have been a fucking shit show. But Vegas made it really easy. You know, as soon as I got a job, as soon as I got $20 in my pocket, I went out and found heroin in that town. And it was very easy. It was very good heroin and very easy to get and very cheap. And I've never been so strung out in my life. And, you know, I was living with my sister, and she knew something was up, but she didn't want to call me out on it. And, you know, I finally was able to move out. I kept a job for a little bit, you know, moved into a fucking pay-by-the-week shithole motel, and tried to keep this habit going and tried to keep a job, and, you know, none of that worked out. And found myself, you know, jobless and strung out and basically on the streets of Vegas, you know, shoplifting every day to support my habit. Stayed in con, you know, my sister finally got me into a detox. I think I was in Vegas for maybe 6-7 months. Detoxed for a week. Had my car out in the parking lot. I walked out the door after a week, you know, picked up my phone in the car and called the dude and scored some dope. but I was able to move back into my sister's because she thought I was sober. And, you know, that lasted maybe a few weeks till they found rigs in my, you know, shoe or whatever again. And that was the end of it, and it was back to Austin. And the last 5 years I was out there, I had been with the same girlfriend off and on. And, you know, she had gotten sober while I was in Vegas. Like I said, I was gone about 6-7 months. In fact, she'd gone to Austin Recovery Outpatient. She was doing pretty well, and... you know, I didn't give a fuck. I showed up at her house with a fucking pocket full of heroin and some cocaine, and she was getting high, you know, that night. And and so I moved back in with her, and this is in October of 14, maybe 6 months before I got sober, I guess, 6-7 months. Got a job at a bar here in Austin, and tried to keep it together, and, you know, It's a lot harder to get heroin here in Austin, and it's a lot shittier, you know, coming from Vegas. And it was difficult keeping it together, you know. and I finally lost that job at the bar. You know, I'd be sick, I couldn't come in, or I'd be late because I was trying to score, all the typical bullshit, you know, that you lose jobs over when you're a junkie. And, you know, the girlfriend was like, you know, hey, she goes, I can't do this anymore. She has two kids. She's like, I'm moving back to my mom's in San Marcos. She's like, you're gonna have to fucking figure something out. And you know, I was getting to the point, things had gradually been just getting sort of darker and darker for me, you know, emotionally, spiritually, whatever you want to call it. And by that point, you know, I'd started just wanting to die, you know. I realized, you know, because for those last 7 years, you know, there was Suboxone, there was methadone, there was, you know, trying to just drink. There, you know, what I, you know, I'd been trying to make it work. I'd been trying to control it. I'd been trying to not let it get out of hand. And I think I was at a point where I knew I couldn't do it, you know. But I was scared to admit it, you know, because who wants to look like a fucking pussy, right? And that was my, you know, looking back, I think that was ultimately what my biggest fear was. I didn't want to ask for help. I didn't want to admit that I couldn't do it myself. So that last couple months, you know, I'm jobless. I'm in this apartment. She's gradually moving out. And, you know, most of the time I was dope sick. And then, like, every few days, maybe I'd scrape up, like, $20, go get a bag, you know, get high for a day, and then, you know, do it all over again. Sick and just daydreaming about killing myself. You know, what I wanted to do, what I wished I could have done, was just afford a big enough shot to fucking put myself out of my misery. And it just never fucking happened, you know. and so that went on. Till 2 days before my sobriety date on May 8th. I don't know where the fuck I got some money. I went and scored some dope. I guess I'd forgotten that I'd done a Xanax that morning, and I went over to Chalmers Courts and scored some heroin, and I did the shot right there in the apartment. And I remember I sort of came to, and I was standing up, and there's like five people standing around me staring at me. And they were like, dude, you were out, you were blue, we were giving you CPR, and fucking homeboy hit you with some Narcan. And I was like, oh. And I was just like, cool, you know. And I walked back in the other room and bought another 20, and I remember hearing this girl go, is he buying more? You know, and that's how it was. You know, I didn't care. Next day was Saturday, and I went out to Levitation Fest that night, and somehow we had some VIP passes, and I remember we were shooting garbage cocaine in the porta potties at this music fest, and went home that night, and I fucking passed out. I'd probably been up for a couple days, and the next morning, somehow it comes out that my girlfriend got some more cocaine while I was asleep the night before, so of course I lose my shit like you do. And I mean, you know, I lost it. I was threatening her. I think I grabbed a knife. Maybe I was threatening to kill myself. I said some crazy shit. And I remember she didn't say anything. She just walked out of the apartment. And so I was sitting there, you know, not knowing what I was going to do. No money. And next thing you know, in the distance, I hear sirens, right? And I just knew they were coming. I knew they were coming. And I'm like, God damn it. And I'm trying to find my clothes. I'm trying to find my shoes. And I can't find my car keys. So at one point, I finally peek through the blinds, and I look downstairs, and I see the black and whites, and I can see they're, like, looking for the apartment number. And by the time I get my shoes on, I open the door, and there's, you know, 10 of these motherfuckers down there with the shields and the helmets and shit. And, you know, she had called. And, you know, I kind of hands up. I'm like, what's up, guys? And, they're like, hey, your girlfriend called, you know, she's a little concerned about you, and, you know, I almost talked my way out of it, I feel like, that day. I was close. In fact, so much so that they called her back to, like, you sure that what you said happened, and she's like, yeah. And so they're like, man, she's pretty adamant about what she says, and then they pat me down, find a fucking syringe in my pocket, and I was like, look, man, you know, I'm a drug addict, but, you know. And the guy, you know, the cop guy that was kind of running the show there was like, you know, we think maybe you should go someplace and get checked out, maybe get some help. And so I end up in the Breckenridge psych ward that night. And, you know, by this point, I'm sick, and I'm just laying in the little plastic bed there. And, you know, I was done, you know. I didn't know what I was going to do next. If they had let me out right then, I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I was out of fucking ideas. And the doctor came in that night, and they were like, hey, you know, you kind of seem like you're probably okay, and we're thinking about letting you go, you know, letting you out of here in the morning. And I remember I didn't say anything, because I don't think I really wanted to leave, you know, because, again, I had no fucking idea what I was going to do. And so maybe they picked up on that, but they just left me alone. And the whole next day went by, and then the next night they came in, and they said, hey, we think we found a place for you to detox if you're down with that. And I was like, you know, whatever. You know, at this point I was just like, you know, tell me where to go. Still though, I gotta say, I wasn't thinking about getting sober. But I wasn't thinking about, I don't know. I just didn't know, you know. I didn't know what the fuck I was gonna do. And so They get me into a place where I detox for about 10 days. And those people, you know, got me to OSAR, got me some funding, and ultimately got me here. And, you know, still wasn't thinking about sobriety. And I get to Austin Recovery, and I was probably here. Well, I can say that, you know, I got here on a Wednesday. And that first Saturday, turns out it was Chris's brother comes and brings a meeting here. And it was the first time, I heard his story. And it was the first time I'd ever, you know, kind of, I'm like, oh, what? Wait a minute. You know, it sounds, you know, his story was familiar. And it sounded a lot like my story. And, you know, I don't know. I paid attention. And, you know, I think that maybe I believed what he said, you know, for the first time. Believed that, you know, maybe this program actually did work for somebody, you know. Somebody that had drank and got high like me. And so I think that kind of cracked the door, you know. Maybe it got my curiosity going a little. And, you know, I was still chain smoking cigarettes and telling war stories out back and not really wanting to be here. And then, like, some days went by, and I, you know, I tried to call my mom because, you know, historically, I'm in rehab, I can call my mom. You know, I didn't have any fucking cigarettes, right? So call my mom, be like, hey, you know, look at me, I'm in rehab, send me some money for cigarettes. Well, this time I call, and my stepdad answers the phone. He's not going to put my mom on the phone. He's like, look, he goes, we're done. He goes, you know, figure it out, but your mom and I are done, and basically hangs up on me. I remember I was fucking furious, you know. How the fuck could you do this to me, you know? But over the next couple days, you know, I think I realized that, you know, I had burned every fucking bridge, you know. I had nobody left to manipulate. I had nobody left to bullshit, nobody left to borrow money from, and that, you know, if I didn't do something different, you know, where am I going to be? Right where I fucking was, I guess. You know, and it could always be worse, you know. I mean, I should have been in prison forever, you know. But, and I should have been dead a whole bunch of times. And, you know, the worst part is, you know, I wanted to die and it just never happened. I just kept going on miserable, you know. And that's, I guess that's probably what I was afraid of. And so, I kind of, I don't know what happened, and it was, there was no fucking burning bush bolt of lightning, but I decided that I was going to give this program a shot. And I remember, you know, I was still, honestly, I was embarrassed that I was going to do it. You know, I hear, I've been talking so much shit about this program for so many years, and here, you know, now I'm going to be the dude, you know, saying the Serenity Prayer and holding hands with motherfuckers and, you know, doing all this silly shit that I said I would never do. And so I didn't really say anything to anybody. And I think Trey was kind of the same way, except he walked around with his big book everywhere, let everybody know. And I just, you know, I just kind of quietly, I shut the fuck up and I just listened to what these people here had to say. And I did, you know, I did the musical journey, even though I thought it sounded like a bunch of hippie bullshit, and it was fucking amazing. I got to do it 5 times. And I hit about the, I was here, I hit about the 2-week mark, and I realized, you know, at this point I was like, fuck it, I'm going to do it. And I went to my counselor, and I realized I'd wasted my first 2 weeks here. And I asked them if I could get an extension, and they worked it out with OSAR. And I got a 2-week extension, so I was able, you know, I figured I should at least get the full, you know, 30 days, get everything I could out of this this deal out here. And so, you know, and what happened, and it happened so, I don't know, you know, what happened was the obsession was removed almost immediately. And the weirdest part about it is I didn't even really notice it when it happened. And my obsession was, you know, looking back on it, you know, my obsession looked like, you know, I used to watch, if I didn't have drugs, I'd go on YouTube and watch like the first half of intervention episodes so I could watch motherfuckers stick needles in their arms, you know, seriously, or read opiophile, you know, reading the the heroin reviews in Baltimore and Philly. You know, crazy shit. I mean, if I wasn't doing it, you know, I'm watching poppy cultivation, you know, Afghani poppy farmers and shit. Seriously. And so, you know, for the obsession is gone, and I didn't even fucking notice it, which is still to this day, it's insane to me. But, you know, suddenly I'm able to listen, you know, and without, you know, had the obsession not been removed, I don't know that I could have focused on getting sober, but whatever. That's how it worked out for me. And so I started doing the deal, and I found a sponsor while I was in here. And, you know, I got out, and I called my sponsor the day I got out, and we started meeting, and I started doing the work. And how much time do I have, Chris? Okay, thanks. You know, I started meeting with him every week, and you know, my step one experience, I think, you know, I was so fucking stubborn and so, you know, so anti doing this program. I think I really drove myself to some depths that I was able to have a really, really solid first step experience. You know, when I was finally fucking done and finally able to surrender, you know, it was getting me to a point where I had, you know, nothing left. And, you know, I mean, I should have, you know, I had what, you know, I had 1,000 what should have been first step experiences, but, you know, it finally stuck. And, you know, you'll hear people say it's the only step you have to do perfectly. And I believe that, you know, cause you know, not a day goes by that I don't forget how those last few days were, you know, laying in that fucking bed, dope sick, wanting to fucking die, you know. And so, you know, so the first step stuck, and, you know, I haven't relapsed since. And, you know, we worked steps, and, you know, there was the whole God thing, and I'm not going to get it, you know, you'll hear that every meeting you go to in this town, and you'll hear people's problems with God and, you know, the struggle with the higher power, and I had all that. But I was at a point where, you know, I believed that this program worked for other people, and if they were able to get around this higher power shit, you know, so could I. And I got, you know, I was able to find an idea of a higher power that I was comfortable with and move on, you know. And sometimes I wonder, you know, even if it's all placebo bullshit, even if I'm praying to nothing, it works. Who gives a shit, you know? So, you know, meeting with my sponsor every week. And I still, you know, in the beginning, I didn't understand, you know. I'm like, why is this dude meeting with me? Like, what the fuck is he getting out of it, you know? But he showed up every week, and so I showed up every week. And, you know, I'd thank him afterwards. Like, dude, seriously, thanks for, you know. He's like, Scott's all right, man. It keeps me sober. And I was like, whatever, man. Fucking, you know. But, you know, and I kept meeting him, and I kept doing the work, and we got to the fourth step. And I remember, you know, in early sobriety, you know, I'm on fire. I'm going to be the most sober dude in town. And I would hear people talking about dragging their feet on their fourth step or stalling out. And I remember sort of smirking and being like, these motherfuckers, like, I'm going to blast through this thing. And damn if I didn't fucking freeze up on my fourth step. And I bet, you know, 6 weeks, you know, and then the way my sponsor left it, you know, we did the reading, and he gave me basically the assignment, and he was like, so, you know, we don't really need to meet again until you got this thing knocked out. And I was like, all right. And I'm thinking, like, nice, you know, no due date. I can take my time on this thing. And, you know, I drew these nice columns, and I had everything ready to go, but I could not write anything down. I would find anything in the world to do besides write my fourth step. And it got to where I was starting to freak out, you know, and I went to a meeting on Sunday afternoon where I knew my sponsor was speaking, and I kind of pulled him aside afterwards. I was like, hey, dude, I don't know what the fuck's wrong with me. I don't know, you know, I don't know what's going on. I'm stalling out on this thing. And he was like, look, dude, he goes, you're off tomorrow, right? I was like, yeah. He goes, get your notebook, set a timer on your phone for 30 minutes. He goes, start the timer, write for 30 minutes, call me when you're done. And I was just like, oh, okay. And so I did. And I sat down, and I knocked out 30 minutes worth, and then, you know, once I got rolling, I did my fourth step, and then I did my fifth step. And, you know, I'll say, my experience with the fourth step, I, you know, looking at myself and looking at character defects was such a foreign concept to me. You know, my first four-step, I think, just barely scratched the surface. I didn't really understand kind of the depths of how all that shit tied together, especially, you know, it wasn't until, you know, I mean, I did it as thoroughly as I could, but it took, you know, it took listening to people in meetings, and it took seeing my character defects surface again to see, you know, to see them in real time was really how I was able to really comprehend, you know, to understand the way fear, you know, is underlying in everything, and, you know, to see where I'm selfish and self-seeking. And so I will say that, you know, my second four step was a whole lot different than my first. Things are a lot clearer, you know, and as time goes by, you know, more will be revealed, as they say. And that's absolutely been the truth in my experience. you know, and then it came, you know, six and seven, obviously. And when it came to my eighth step, the biggest one, my biggest amends to make was to my father. And at this point, we hadn't had a relationship in 15 years. We'd seen each other once at my sister's wedding, and we pretended to be nice to each other, you know, put on a little show for everybody, but we hadn't really spoken. And so I was going to be in Dallas. I had just done my... You know, I just met with my sponsor doing my ninth step, you know, beginning, starting the ninth step, and talked to my sister, you know, and at this point I'm on good terms. I'm about almost a year sober at this point, maybe 9 months. And I remember talking to my sister. I said, hey, is Dad going to be in town? I was going to be in Dallas for a wedding. And I said, is Dad going to be in town, you know, on whatever weekend? She goes, yeah, actually he is. And I was like, fuck. And so I called him up, and we met and sat down. Hadn't really spoken, like I said, in 15 years, and it was cool, and he was cool, and that kind of, you know, it was the beginning of repairing our relationship. And in 2017, actually, on July 7th, 2017, 2 years ago today, he died. It's suddenly freak accident. You know, and I was able to go to the memorial, you know, having made that amends. And, that, you know, that's one of the biggest things, you know, as far as single events, you know, this program has given me, that I was able to, you know, I had that last year and a half of a relationship with my father. You know, I can't imagine what it would have been like going up there, going to that funeral, if I had even gone to that funeral, you know, if I wasn't sober. But getting to go up there, you know, having made the amends and having had some kind of relationship with him before he died was pretty amazing. And yeah, you know, I still have amends from that first one that I haven't made yet, and the longer I'm sober, the more terrifying they are. And but you know, I've done all the big ones. I've made amends to my whole family. I have a great relationship with my family now. Yeah. 10 and 11, you know, my spiritual program, you know, the spiritual aspect of this whole thing, and it's, I realize, you know, obviously I didn't know going into this what, you know, how big of a, you know, what a percent, you know, how much the spiritual, Jesus Christ, I can't talk, the spiritual aspect of this program, that's not what I was looking for. You know, I wanted to get sober. I didn't give a fuck about God. I didn't give a fuck about praying. That's not what I was looking for. But you know, I realize, you know, it's a huge deal. And, you know, my spiritual practice is pretty minimalist, as I like to tell my friend Bill. You know, I have my prayers that I say, and I have, my version of meditation that I do. And, you know, it's not perfect, but, you know, it's enough to keep me sober. And, you know, I still meet with my sponsor every week, and I have sponsees, and I do service work, whenever I'm asked. And my life today is fucking, it's unrecognizable, you know? It's by no means perfect. You know, and I by no means work a perfect program. I do the best I can, but I still... You know, I still have my character defects. I still act like a fucking selfish asshole sometimes. You know, I have a, I'm in a relationship now. It's the closest thing to a healthy relationship I've ever been in. It's amazing, you know, and I've done, you know, I've made mistakes in sobriety, you know, I've dated, I've done shitty things. I feel like I'm running out of juice here. Kind of wanted to end on a big bang. So listen, you know, and I'll end on this. I know, you know, early in sobriety, I remember hearing somebody share, you know, you'll hear people ask their sponsees, like, have you had enough yet? And this dude is, he's like, you know, what you need to ask people, and especially people that are in treatment right now, you know, it's like, what are you going to do? You know, what's your plan? What are you going to do when you get out of here? And if your plan is anything other than, you know, I'm going to get a fucking sponsor and I'm going to work the steps and I'm going to, you know, work this program to the best of my ability. You know, if your plan is, well, I'm going to just sell weed but not smoke it, or I'm going to go move, you know, if you have any harebrained schemes like that, you know, you probably still got some more experimenting to do. You know, this program, it's simple. It's not always easy. It's definitely uncomfortable at times. But, I mean, the payoff is, I mean, I can't describe, you know, I can't describe what I've gotten out of this program. And I know I'm forgetting a bunch of shit. But thank you all for having me. Thanks, Chris, for asking me. And that's all I got.